From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Jim Harrison had a writing career that spanned some 55 years with more than 40 books, and that brought him wide acclaim, but that was both a blessing and a curse for Harrison. In this country, he never reached superstar celebrity status, which suited him just fine. As he told radio producer Scott Carrier in an interview in 2007, many writers dislike intrusion. They figure their books should say enough about their lives.
Margaret Atwood said a wonderful thing. To want to meet an author because you like his work is the same thing as wanting to talk to a duck because you like pâté.
Jim Harrison died last weekend at the age of 78, and today in the program we're rebroadcasting the conversation with him and Scott Carrier about his life and his work. Join us after the news.
The program you're listening to right now is made possible by more than 5,500 loyal public radio listeners. KUER sustainers give monthly contributions to ensure the station has a reliable source of income. So the next time you learn something new on Science Friday, or you're stuck in your driveway gripped by a conversation on Weekend Edition, give thanks to the sustaining members who are at the heart of the programs that you love. Become a sustainer today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're offering a memorial of sorts to the writer Jim Harrison, who died last weekend at his home in a remote corner of Arizona. Harrison's observations of the world came from his deep understanding of nature and of solitude. And in his more than 40 works of fiction and essays and poetry, he developed a reputation as one of the country's men of letters. He had a distinctive perspective on life and art, and when he came to Salt Lake City back in 2007, we figured it would take a person of his own unique view of the world to interview him. So we asked the writer and radio producer Scott Carrier to talk to Harrison, which he did in the cab of a truck up Emigration Canyon. The two sat side by side. Carrier had a microphone. Harrison had a glass of tequila. We're rebroadcasting that conversation today, which began with Harrison remembering the first time he came to Salt Lake City. He was young and then on his way to California.
Yeah, I hitchhiked through here when I was 16. I was 18 and was going to California, and a kind young woman let me sleep on a restaurant table in the back of this restaurant in Heber. And then I bucked bales over by, what's it called, Fort Duchesne, to get enough money to eat on my way home, you know.
You came back through here, going home.
I was just curious. I had to look at it, you know.
What do you remember about Salt Lake at that time?
It was a lot smaller, you know. It's like the other day I was in Denver on Larimer Street, and it looks a lot different than it did in 1954, not surprisingly, you know.
Right. I know, there's like a new stoplight in the city every day driving around.
Well, that's not for us to say. You know, I'm not sort of romantic. You know, I was in the Florida Keys fishing a lot in the late 60s, 70s, and 80s. And everybody says, oh, it's changed. Well, of course it's changed. You know, we can't stop anything. You can't control anything you don't own.
There's nothing to do about the growth problem?
Well, you know, uncontrolled growth, of course, as I think Ed Abbey, well, Norman Mailer said it too, uncontrolled growth is the logic of the cancer cell. But people seem unwilling to do a great deal about it, you know?
Well, it's still kind of a nice city when the air is, well, when the air is clear.
Yeah, but the nice thing about it's a bit like Tucson. You can get out of it so fast. We're not 10 minutes from town, and it's lovely. There's not very many places where the outside becomes that beautiful that fast.
Right.
So you guys are lucky, you know.
Right.
I remember taking that old road from Provo over that goes over toward Heber. Once when I visit, you know that movie director Sidney Pollack?
Yeah.
We were doing a project together about 20 years ago, and he had that house over in Sundance. So we had to come from Sundance back then to Provo to get groceries. I mean good groceries, because I was making a French meal. I was making a ratatouille, that French vegetable dish, and some veal chops, huh?
What's Sidney Pollack?
Oh, I liked him a lot. He's an intensely literate, which is not that common in show business.
I was reading I've been reading some of the interviews you've done with other people, and one of them you said more people read books in Hollywood than in New York.
Well, I think as a general rule, I might have been just nagging the New Yorkers, but demographically, L.A. is a bigger book-reading audience than New York City. New York City, they're drinking spritzers and talking about themselves. You know what I mean?
But New York is really the publishing
kingdom. The center of publishing. I always thought it should be in Minneapolis, you know, for a fair view of the country. And a much lower overhead, you know. That's why books cost $25. When I started writing, I think Legends of the Fall cost $5.95. Now suddenly, 28 years later, books are $25, you know.
Right. Do you feel like you were kind of ignored by the New York critics of the New York publishing world for a while?
Well, a little while. It didn't bother me too much because I was making a living. I think for a writer, if your books are in print and you're making a living, you have no cause. As a literary novelist, if you could support yourself, you have no cause for a complaint, because even, you know, for 20 years I'd been doing so well in France, and that more than made up for it, ego-wise, made up for New York's perhaps neglect, you know. I mean, if you're hot in Paris, it's even pleasanter than New York, you know?
I bet.
Food's better.
What is that like, to be like a superstar in France?
Oh, I said to my wife, if I was doing as well in America as I was doing, as I'm doing in France, we'd have to live in Mexico or British Columbia, because, you know, I've always lived in rather remote areas, and right. I'm not fond of intrusions, you know.
People would come after you, try to find
you. Yeah, that kind of thing, because Margaret Atwood said a wonderful thing. To want to meet an author because you like his work is the same thing as wanting to talk to a duck because you like pâté. You know, you get what I mean? I mean, the books are there. The books are hopefully more interesting than the person, you know?
Yeah. But Holden Caulfield, he really wanted to meet Isaac Dennison.
Yeah, I don't blame him. You know, my friend Guy de La Valdan, his mother was a close friend of Isaac Dennison. And I must say that was maybe the one author, other than Faulkner, who didn't want to meet anyone, you know. You know, Faulkner got tired of visitors, so he took his old Ford tractor and plowed up his driveway, you know.
And Salinger is still alive, but nobody's seen him in years? Or?
Yeah, I think that's a more severe form of that neurosis. I think he felt that he had been mistreated and just decided to disappear. It didn't evidently help his writing, because he's published almost nothing since he disappeared. You see what I mean?
Maybe he's holding on to stuff, or do you think he just stopped writing?
I doubt it. I doubt it. You know, I knew Truman Capote, and Capote kept talking about, even to me, you know, to lie to a fellow writer is a little odd, but about this immensely long novel, he was just changing from the first person to the third person. Well, and then Capote said it was 1,000 pages long, but when he died, they found out it didn't exist. You know, that he had sort of just been seized up for the last decade of his life, which is sad. I think it's easier to stay functional as an artist if you live rather remotely, you know, like I do in Montana or down on the Mexican border.
I wanted to ask you about Salinger, because sometimes when I'm reading your stories, the character reminds me a little bit of Holden Caulfield.
Hmm.
He writes in the first person, and Holden, you're a lot inside Holden's mind as much as you are following the action in this story. And you often, not always in your stories, but you write in about your characters, you have them tell the story first person.
Well, I do, because as Rilke, Rainer Maria Rilke, the Austrian poet, said, sometimes you have to think, who is this third person? Who is this third person that we write in?
The omniscient narrator who's invisible.
But why not try to totally inhabit your characters? And then, of course, the dangerous thing is you sort of become the characters, and it's sometimes hard, like a method actor, to get out of the part, you know?
Right. Like, you wake up very early in the morning, and you enter the mind or soul of other people, basically.
Well, hopefully. Yeah, you have to inhabit all your characters. Walker Percy wrote a wonderful essay called The Reentry Problem. Now, how do you get out of your characters back into your own?
Well, first, how do you get into the character?
Well, that's just because to be a good writer, I think you have to be immensely naked and vulnerable to the nature of the human race. I mean, some are harder. I had a great deal of trouble when I wrote Dalva to fully inhabit a woman in order to speak in her voice, partly because I'm a man, but to catch the entirety of her character was difficult indeed. You know,
you write as a woman very well. I mean, I remember reading A Woman Lit by Fireflies, and I didn't know a man wrote it. I missed your name at the start. I started to read it, and I was stunned when I read that you were the author of that.
Yeah, a lot of people actually were. You know, that appeared in the New Yorker magazine. It was quite comic.
That's why I read it, yeah.
I got about a couple hundred letters from women that the same thing had happened when they determined they can't live with her husband a minute longer, and they just disappeared.
She walked away from him on a freeway rest stop.
Yeah, at a rest stop in Iowa, she walked off through the cornfield. You know, and I like the idea. You know that old biblical thing, Ruth amongst the alien corn, you know, the Old Testament thing. But it's just the idea of walking through a cornfield where you're truly lost, but then you get to the other side, a new life, you know, that kind of thing.
So how do you get into a woman's mind?
I'm not so sure. Like in the case of Dalva, I dreamed her.
Yeah, you dreamed that she was sitting on a porch in Santa Monica longing for home.
Longing for home, because that's what really invades that book, is that character of longing, you know, that... I remember when we had to, for economic reasons, I had to leave Northern Michigan and teach out on Long Island for 2 years, my first and last teaching job. I would just get a lump beneath my breastbone, you know, of such intense longing for the trackless forests of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and the rivers and so on. That character of longing just over for our homeland can overwhelm us, you know. You know, it's Canaan land, as they probably say locally, you know, to get back to where you feel at home.
It's a biological thing, maybe.
I think you might be right, you know, because it's even what controls your dream life, your first perceptions, you know. You're 1.5 years old. Your parents have an old cabin that your father and his brothers, who came back from World War II, not in very good shape, they built this wonderful cabin for $900 materials, you know, and they all knew how to build a cabin. And we lived there in the summer for years, but I can remember this, a mere child wandering off into the forest. Just the wonderment of it all.
That's Jim Harrison, who died last weekend at the age of 78. He spoke with radio producer Scott Carrier back in 2007. Scott has a podcast you should check out. It's called Home of the Brave. You can get to it at homebrave.com. We'll take a brief break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting a conversation between the writer Jim Harrison and the radio producer Scott Carrier. They spoke together in the cab of a pickup truck up Emigration Canyon back in 2007. Harrison died last weekend at the age of 78.
Who was it? Carl Jung said, in dreams, animals are your soul chasers. They're tracking your soul to try to help you recover it.
You have dreams of bears and birds.
Yeah, I was 25 years. I had this remote cabin in the UP, and I would see bears all the time. You know, they were visitors.
So you had this dream of Dalva sitting on a porch in Santa Monica longing for home. What happened then? How did you end up?
Well, I don't know. You know, sometimes, here's a way of putting it in a non-vulgar sense. The goose that lays the golden egg shouldn't be craning around looking at his butt. You see what I mean? You should just let it happen. And for some reason, you know, like Jung said, for men, he said, what have we done with our twin sister, whom the culture forces us to abandon at birth? You know, this isn't saying in cheap psychological way that we have a feminine part, because in actuality, we're all female for the first few days of our conception, you know. And then some of us become male and some don't, you know. That's our origin. Well, my mother had five sisters. I had a wife and two daughters and female dogs, cats, female chickens, female horses. So it's not surprising that I would understand females.
Your most recent book, Returning to Earth, is about death in the family. It's a lot about death, or how the family responds to the man who's like the linchpin in the family dying.
Yeah, I mean, the strongest man, you know. I mean, Cynthia, you know, like Dalva, his wife, Donald's wife's an improbably strong woman. Unlike the weakness of her brother as a son, she had a lovely life raising children with Donald, who was a construction worker, cement finisher, and then he had his own little construction company.
Now you're talking about them in the third person, which doesn't happen in the book. These things, some of these things came out in the book and some of them didn't, because they speak about themselves in the first person and they leave a lot out.
Well, sure, you always leave a lot out because you're painting the picture that you're thinking about, you know. And a lot, you know, when Donald gets to the point where he's telling his story, the story of his ancestors, four generations, he finally says to himself, I got to tell some bad parts, you know, of some wrong things I've done. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just altogether proper. I mean, my daughters know that their father wasn't always a hero. You right. Get what I mean?
Right, right.
He could be a bad person, too,
right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
But everything is family, mostly in my work. It occurred to me when a French critic pointed that out. That's still the family unit is where I emerge from, you know?
In this book, Donald dies. He writes the first section of the book, and it goes up to the point where he describes the spiritual experience he had spending 3 days in the woods in Canada.
Well, it's traditional amongst the spiritual-minded Anishinaabe, or Chippewas, they call them, or Ojibways. But if you want to sort out your life, this isn't a short vision quest. You know, the con job that they're selling for a couple hundred bucks. This is 3 days, three nights without food, water, or shelter.
So when he dies, he wants to go back there.
Well, yeah, because that was the source of his acceptance in life. You know, when he was seeing everything from all sides at once, you know.
On the first day, there's a storm, and he almost gets hit by lightning. And on the second day, he's visited by a bear who, it's a female bear that at first wants to fight him, and then she comes back and she's like hitting on him.
Yeah, she thinks he occurs to maybe she's, because Donald's a big guy, and he's sort of, well, frankly, he has what they call bear medicine, you know, and that's what his daughter perceives, because she can't accept her father's death, you know. I mean, when my father died at 53, it was just simply unbearable to my younger brother and sister who were 10 and 11, had no conception. You know, it was just the blunt fact that their father and sister had died in a car accident. Well, that was the point at which, if this can happen to people you love, I may as well do what I want and become a writer, because what else am I supposed to... Everything else is inconceivable at this point, if life is that utterly fragile, you know? Wow. Yeah.
So, all right, but on the third day, Donald is visited by three big ravens who stand on the ground in front of him. Yeah. And he thinks they want to know why he's there.
Well,
so he tells them. He tells them why he's there. What does he say?
Well, he's there. He's there to find out about his life, and then he includes the fact that he had seen a raven funeral before, and he has this intuition that though he's in his mid-40s, he's not long for the earth. You know, he doesn't know in what form it's going to come, you know. But
he has a vision that he's going to get sick and die.
Yeah. But then, as he says, he already accepts that because everything that's born dies. But then you tend to think of it, as they do in old traditional ways, that it's a continuum, because I remember when I had sort of a satori or awakening, and I realized that no one is born and no one dies, you know, in that technical sense, you know, like in a poem I said, we'll all see God, but not with our eyes, you know, that kind of sense, the mystery, the great mysterium that is life, you know.
Right, he says after this 3 days, he says it was comforting or a relief to realize that the spirit is everywhere and not just a thing that's separate.
Yeah, well, of course it is, but that realization is profound, you know. I remember once when I had a moment like that, I sat down on a stump during a troubled time. I sat there on this old pine stump for hours without moving, and warblers landed on me. You know, it was during the migration in May. And that was a marvelous experience to have birds landing on you like you were an object, that you had become a stump, you know?
Donald says he learned to see himself as animals see him, and then he became a snake.
Well, yeah, but see, here's the thing. This Hasid, you know, the Jewish religion said, don't you think the reality is an aggregate of the perceptions of all creatures? That delightful. Indian name was true from Legends of the Fall. That man, one who sees as a bird, which is an interesting point of view. That was his name, the Cheyenne, one who sees as a bird.
Huh. He has this experience 2 years before he becomes sick, and then he gets sick with Lou Gehrig's disease, and instead of just wasting away, he decides that he wants to choose the day of his death.
Well, which is actually, which is understandable. This is an utterly horrid disease, and by that time already, it can be very aggressive. You know, like, I've talked to a couple of them. You know, like when you have a severe cramp in your leg from running?
Yeah.
Well, his entire body becomes a cramp like that. Even his brain, his face, his tongue, his heart, everything. That's the degenerative cycle of the disease.
But he doesn't talk about that. When he's speaking, he doesn't really talk about the pain.
No, because it's not in his culture to talk about your private pain. It's the common good. There's a reason why they're tribal. They're not romantic heroes. I wrote a goofy little poem about the romantic hero on a plane, all alone, you know, in the universe. And he thinks, luckily, there's a pilot on this buggy. You know, we are not alone. That was a fiction in 19th century England, the romantic hero, you know.
So he's wasting away.
Yeah.
And
well, he decides to choose the moment and the place of his death, you know.
The summer solstice, and he wants to go back to the place where he had this spiritual experience.
Well, this power vision, yeah. Well, that would be altogether beautiful and natural place to die. But see, I'm not talking about politics and laws or euthanasia. I just don't, and I'm a Democrat, but I don't understand a government that wants to invade every moment of our life. You know, the government's supposed to be here for us, not us for them, don't you think?
Yeah.
So why are they snooping and all this stuff the way people live? I've noticed more and more in America there's a kind of a corrosive, parsimonious spirit, you know, an invasive feeling of the government. I don't know, as to say I'm a Democrat and I'm all for the social good, but lighten up, there's a kind of social Maoism going on now. You know, it's like they were laughing in Seattle. You know, I smoke, but they passed a law in Seattle. No smoking in restaurants, which is okay by me. Bars, I mean, give me a break. People ought to smoke in bars. But in Seattle, they don't want you smoking within 20 feet of the entrance of the bar. So there are some streets where there are a lot of bars, which, of course, now this is outside, mind you. Now, what is this social Maoism that allows people to make these kind of laws, you know?
Yeah, they're doing it here now as well.
Well, I mean, it's crazy. You're outside. America's outside. Give me a break. Meanwhile, there are 12 million children with no health insurance. I mean, get real. You know, could go do something real. Instead of saying no, say yes. Get those 12 million kids health insurance, for God's sake.
Donald's family, irregardless of the laws, they load him in a car and drive him across the border into Canada. They dig a grave. They sit him down beside the grave and inject him with phenobarbital and Dilantin, and then he dies.
Yeah, they left him down there and put him on the cedar boughs. This is his request.
And his wife sings some songs in his ear, and then they bury him.
Yeah.
And drive home.
Yeah.
Is that how the book started, with that image for you? Is
it? No. The book started like True North, the first part of it, though the novels exist independently, is that we all have to face this in our culture, which is a very non-traditional culture. death keeps coming to people, to families, as a surprise. What did they think was going to happen? You know, we forget in our non-traditional culture that this is part of life. You know, which is much less true in Europe, for instance, you know, where you have an official year-long mourning period, you know. That's why the Chippewas have the ghost suppers in November, where you throw the tobacco on the fire and let these spirits go. They don't want to hang around here. It's like kind of this Indian, he died 34. I saw his tombstone up in the Upper Peninsula. Love me, but let me go. Love me, but let me go. Well, don't try to hold my spirit on earth, you know.
Which is what the rest of the book is about. The other three stories is about how his family lets him go.
Accommodates. How the family accommodates to this, you know.
Well, let me ask you first before we talk about that. Is that the way you'd like to die, the way that Donald dies?
Well, no, that's his way. I'm not an Indian. I come from sort of poor farmers on both sides. These were working people, you know.
But Donald dies surrounded by his family, and also the story about the Raven funeral.
Well, I saw this at my cabin. I was sitting there with my dog. Then I noticed the ravens start coming into this immense hemlock in the edge of the clearing. There's a real old raven that I got to know over the years. You know, you could get to know them individually. And he was dying. And about three dozen other ravens were hanging out with him. And it took him about an hour and a half. The whole thing took a couple hours. He was falling down through the tree and just sort of grabbing on. But I heard, I actually heard in the silence of that afternoon, I heard him hit the ground with sort of a fluffing sound. But all the other ravens, they stayed around about 2 hours. They kept circling the tree because they're... What I deduced was their patriarch was dying. You know, ravens could live really a long time, 40, 50 years, you know. Yeah, become old birds and have extended families, you know.
And so he died with, this raven died with his family?
His family around him, you know.
And Donald died the same way.
Well, yeah, that's the right way to go, you know.
That's the writer Jim Harrison speaking with radio producer Scott Carrier in the cab of Scott's truck up Emigration Canyon back in 2007. Harrison died last weekend at his home in Arizona. He was 78 years old. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting a conversation between the writer Jim Harrison and the radio producer Scott Carrier. They spoke together in the cab of a pickup truck up Emigration Canyon back in 2007. Harrison died last weekend at the age of 78.
Cynthia, in the book, her part of the story lasts a year.
Well,
she describes the year of mourning.
Well, but she has a really hard time because when he's dying, he says, you better get yourself another boyfriend, you know, because she's the vigorous woman. You know, women, like men, remain vigorous a lot longer. And a woman in her mid-40s and on past that is sexually vigorous, and we need love. You know, we need affection. We need people hugging us and us hugging people. That's part of the human condition, you know.
Right.
So Cynthia can't quite face up to that, and she becomes quite ill, but then she gradually begins to recover and start her life over.
First she ends up in the hospital in a coma.
With a real severe pneumonia. But the real problem was the daughter, Claire, who's holding on to anything, and she thinks maybe her father's become a bear, you know, which is possible. Did you read Rockwell's anthropological study, Giving Voice to the bear in different native cultures throughout the United States?
I didn't read that, but she does in the book.
Well, yeah, does she? I forgot, you know, because oddly enough, I've written a whole nother novel since then. I'm a busy boy. But Claire, the daughter, thinks it's possible that her daddy, her beloved daddy, you know, they used to fish and hike together and everything, maybe he's become a bear, and then she can make contact with him herself by sleeping in a sleeping bag in this hut out in the forest in the winter. And, you know, the winter up there is really awful, you know, 40 below, 30 below.
And the mother's worried about her
more than she is about herself. Mother displaces her worry about herself into her daughter. Mothers do that. Mothers can be in horrible shape physically and mentally, and they displace it by worrying about their children. I noticed that my own wife.
It kind of comes around for them when the mother and the daughter, Cynthia and Claire, are out for a walk on some sand dunes and eating strawberries next to the sand dunes.
The wild strawberries up there. Yeah, this is a strange area near Grand Marais on Lake Superior in Michigan, not the Minnesota Grand Marais, because there's a cement. Immense national seashore where these dunes run about 12 or 14 miles, a couple miles deep, and they're hundreds and hundreds of feet high, you know. And there's little pockets of vegetation, and so very eerie area. And
why did you choose that area?
Well, because one detail, the bears of the spring, May, the first vegetation is beech pea, like a wild pea, and then wild strawberries. The bears come out of the forest. We do too. The Finns up there used to go out and pick that beech pea because that was their first fresh vegetable in 5 or 6 months, you know, after those long winters. I mean, I've seen sort of icebergs up there in early May.
You like that?
Harsh climate, yeah. So, yeah, I like it. It's very primal. Yeah.
So they're out there, and what happens?
Well, they see the bear feeding, and she thinks, they're both thinking, maybe that's Daddy. He goes over the hill, as we all must.
That's the last line of the book.
Yeah.
And that's a closure for them, or what would you call that?
Well, of course, but I don't like that word closure. Or healing, all those words. You know, they keep talking about healing now before the blood is dry in the pavement. What did Rilke say? The exposed heart is richest in suffering. Huh. But, of course, he also said there's a point at which the exposed heart can't recover. You know, there are these wounds some people have. You know, they're evil. I was very pleased with Norman Mailer. Unlike New York intellectual says, please, there is good and evil. There is good and evil. Please. It's not a sociological phenomenon. There's evil. And I was trying to write about the childhood of Hitler. What else are we to think, you know?
So let's talk about the United States now. Do you think America's lost its soul since 9/11? Or do you think it's changed?
Well, of course, it's changed. I don't know about losing its soul. That's too dramatic. We've had other periods of more severe crisis. If you can remember, you're younger than me, that period when Martin Luther King, JFK, Bobby Kennedy were all assassinated. You know, that was a tougher time than now, Vietnam, you know.
You think so?
Oh, without doubt. I mean, God, 50,000 young men died in Vietnam. I mean, we're up to 3,000 now, which is chopped liver. But I have an idea that neither party, I had this idea that I talked to a New York lawyer about. I said, how about a class action suit against Yale for graduating both Bush and Kerry? I'm not picking on one or another. These guys are C students. Think of giving a diagnostic test in American and world history to the members of Congress. Wouldn't that be an alarming result? Huh? It would be fun, wouldn't it? You boys sit down. I'm going to give you a test. Here's 100 questions on our past. Do any of you know?
Well, do you think we have a serious problem now in America?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think in those terms. I see it as a continuum. I mentioned the Vietnam area. I mentioned the Civil War. Millions.
Right.
You know, there's a battalion out of Battle Creek, and only 8% of them returned. You know, that's why I find the Civil War unbearable even to read. Or I passed Verdun on a book tour in northern France. I was passing. A road sign said, Verdun, please remember that 800,000 people died there in 10 days in the Battle of Verdun.
In the First World War.
Yeah, in the First World War. Think of the Jews. Think of the Native Americans that got wiped out. So I don't see us as particularly... We changed our country too much in response to 9/11, you know. I mean, Arab terrorists are very cagey like that. Why should we keep doing this? We've already won this one with one fell swoop, as they say. We don't have to. Well, 9/11, they don't. That's peculiar to their character. They don't feel they have to keep doing this. They did it once. You see what I mean? So this idea at the airports, on this book tour, I've been in a lot of airports. You see an 85-year-old woman trying to struggle to get off her shoes, right? Then you realize there's thousands and tens of thousands of shipping containers that aren't inspected at all. You know, there are thousands of trucks coming over the border from Canada and Mexico that aren't inspected. But meanwhile, we're giving the third degree to this 85-year-old woman.
What do you think that's about?
We just don't know how to handle the situation. You know, in our old days, our elders got to work on time. But as time goes on, congressmen work fewer and fewer hours. You know, they're only 2.5 days a week. It used to be 5. They don't know anything anyway, you know. I mean, what it's about is nobody's taking charge. You know, like FEMA. And FEMA in New Orleans... Try to think, without sentimentality, how Ike Eisenhower would have handled New Orleans. Are you kidding? It'd all be done by now.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's just these loudmouths pushing the blame on each other. Nobody's taking charge. Okay, locally. How about Brigham Young taking over the New Orleans problem? Are you? It would have been done in 3 months.
Yeah.
Are you kidding? These were a different kind of man, you know? I mean, give me a break. All you got are all these people blaming each other, you know, trying to take credit, you know?
You don't see Bush as an evil man.
No, not at all. He intellectually is rather innocent compared to the people around him, you know, like Roe, but I don't see him as particularly evil. He has some problems as a dry alcoholic, you know. You know, alcoholics that quit drinking but that didn't get over the problems of what caused them to drink that much. They call that a dry alcoholic.
What do you think are the problems that made him drink?
Well, who knows? probably his mom in this case, from what I've read and heard. You know, his father wasn't a bad guy. I remember Otis Carney was a sort of a rich guy, but knew both father and son. George Jr. is just a product of our time with total situational morality. And the idea of trying to introduce religion in the government, can he figure out that this hasn't worked in the Middle East? You know what I mean? But now the guy, you almost feel sympathetic. Here he is trying to adjudicate a religious war in Iraq with American bodies. I mean, he's lost. It's now no longer about Saddam Hussein or anything. It's the Sunni and the Shiites. Well, the idea that none of our congressmen seem to know the difference is interesting, right, isn't it?
Yeah.
That this is a war, a religious war that started in 632. You know, a division, a schism. It's sort of like the Catholics and Methodists fighting it out to death.
Right.
You know what I mean? He's lost it all now, you know?
Let me ask you a bit about environmental stuff. You write as well as anybody about the environment. You can make natural scenes become very vivid in my mind, and yet you're not called an environmental writer.
Well, how could I be? I'm just writing about life, like I write about food, because we eat three times a day. But the whole, you can't separate the environmental struggles from what we are, you know, from our culture, you know. And now it's largely, I come from a profound Christian background, and you would think our biggest problem is greed, you know, greed in biblical terms, cupidity as we used to call it, just pure greed,
right,
you know. I mean, if there's an antichrist, it's greed. You know, in the old days, I remember in church when I was a boy, about the rich man that owned three camels and a granary full of grain. And that was a dangerous moral tradition, to be that rich, to have those camels and a granary full of grain. I mean, obviously, I'm a successful man myself, but it's also always puzzled me. I remembered when I was at the top of my farm, and my mother said to me, this is before she died, "What did Hollywood pay you for writing that screenplay?" And I said, $500,000. And my mother said, "Well, your father, you know, is an agriculturist, agronomist. I mean, that's 50 times what he ever made in a year." And I says, "That's not my fault, Mama. That's what they paid me." You know, she was a Swede, you know. She would say, "You made quite a living out of your fibs." You know, that's a Swedish compliment, you know.
So you think greed is the main problem to our environmental problems?
Oh, of course. Like, why the UP is lovely. A lot of parts of it, because they can't make any more money out of it. It's just all spawned up, wild and torn up land with, you know, dozens of miles with no human inhabitants. That's why I love it. We live in a ghost world of huge stumps. Huh. The trees are gone, but we have the stumps, you know?
Yeah, it's the same out in the Basin and Range in Nevada.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah, I know.
There's no stumps out there, but there's nothing.
Well, they can't make any money on them, but it seems to be a natural thing. And to try to fool God into your greed is what worries me. If you read the New Testament, which I was going to be a preacher when I was 15, so I read the New Testament dozens of times in the Bible, I'd see no excuse for ignoring the poor. Or, like I say, 12 million children without health insurance. What's going on? Christ told us to take care of these people. Right. He didn't tell us to just make a whole bunch of money and ignore them.
Right.
Do you think?
Right.
I don't get that, you know.
Is there anything about the environment in the New Testament?
Well, sure. You know, when Christ, look at what Christ did. When he was troubled about his fate, his future, he spent 40 days in the wilderness alone. In other words, he did a 40 days solo. You see what I mean? You know, the earth is part of God's body. You know, I created a false organization just to pin people down. I said, I'm the president of the Christian Environmentalists. How can you do this to God's body? That was fun. It made people nervous because it was getting them where they live, you know?
Yeah, I was at a conference a couple of days ago at a university, and the panel was discussing what kind of a war would Jesus allow.
It's a ridiculous question. God is not your buddy. He's the master of the universe. There's 90 billion galaxies. Imagine that. It makes me vertiginous. There's 15 galaxies for everybody alive on Earth. I mean, the immensity of the universe, the immensity of the nature of human life and animal and insect life. How can you reduce God to somebody who helps you in your business? I mean, that's blasphemy, if you ask me. Mm-hmm. Blasphemy, pure blasphemy. Mm-hmm. But here we are having a little drink and smoking an illegal cigarette in America.
That's Jim Harrison and Scott Carrier. Their conversation was recorded back in 2007. Harrison died last weekend at his home in Arizona. You can check out Scott Carrier's podcast. It's called Home of the Brave by visiting homebrave.com. He has a lot of great stories that you really should check out. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.